Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I think that the USA has a moral obligation to be with us.
Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya gets support from President Joe Biden in her fight for democracy. Now she tells me what needs to happen after the photo op. Then, in Belarus, Russia, and elsewhere, authoritarian leaders crack down on journalists. I speak with investigative reporter Alexei Kovalev about taking risks to stand up to the state. Plus,
that's why I took a step back, because I didn't want to do something silly out there and get injured.
Performance psychology expert Dr. Colleen Hacker explores what happens when an athlete's mental state causes physical risk. And
we're having to intubate patients again and cry with their loved ones as they pass away again. And we're just thinking, it doesn't have to be this way.
Hari Srinivasan speaks with practitioners on the ground in Tennessee about the human toll of vaccine denial.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Galadriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. After days of uncertainty, an important act of diplomacy has finally happened, and it played out in President Biden's Twitter feed. He posted a photograph of his meeting with Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, saying that he was honored to meet with her at the White House. Mr. Biden added that the United States stands with the people of Belarus in their quest for democracy and universal human rights. The face-to-face talks placed the White House seal of approval on her campaign to ratchet up international pressure on Belarus strongman Alexander Lukashenko. But Lukashenko is going to great lengths to crack down on independent reporters, as the world saw when he forced a passenger jet to land in Belarus and seized dissident journalist Roman Protasevich. Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin is another old hand at suppressing journalism, and the intensity of the crackdown seems to be rising. Just yesterday, Russian security officers raided the home of Roman Dropokhotov, editor of the independent news site The Insider. We're going to go now to Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Good to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. I know that we spoke just a few weeks ago, and this was prior to your trip to the United States, where you met with many leaders here and those that work in the administration. But there had been questions as to whether you would actually meet with President Biden. You yourself doubted that that would happen just Monday. And here we are yesterday, that famous photo now of you and President Biden. How did this meeting come about?
No, first of all, I'm so grateful for this meeting, because it was important for Belarusians, for us to, you know, have this political will. And it was very, very warm and sensitive meeting. I'm really glad I met the person who says that it's ongoing struggle between autocracy and democracy. And so as Belarus is on the front line of this fight, so the USA will be with Belarusians in this difficult moment.
Yeah, and you spoke with reporters shortly after that meeting outside of the White House. You said that the meeting lasted about 15 minutes. And you said, I am leaving the White House with confidence that the United States will be with Belarusians both now and later after a new election. Prior to this meeting, you had expressed some discouragement that you weren't getting real tangential issues resolved. You weren't getting promises from the White House as to what they would do, what actions they would take. Did you get any actions, any promises from President Biden yesterday?
Look, we are not looking for promises. Our task is to explain what's going on in Belarus and how the USA could be helpful in our resistance to dictatorship. And we discussed a lot. We understand that we will communicate further, and we together try to look for ways out of the situation. And what the USA can do is isolate Lukashenko's regime politically, diplomatically, and financially, assist civil society, assist those mass media and businesses that have to relocate from the country, and of course prisoners and their families. And we also talked about a future vision of Belarus. We will need to restore our country, because at the moment regime is destroying all the NGOs, destroying civil society, media, and we will need assistance in the future as well. So a lot have been discussed, and you know, I'm sure that everything we discussed will be fulfilled. It's not about promises, it's about commitment.
Well, we know that the United States, along with other European allies, has imposed sanctions on Belarus following the downing of that Ryanair flight and the detaining of Roman Protasevich. But you have actually pushed that what needs to be taken next to really put Lukashenko in a bind is sanctions against those entities closest to him, those companies closest to him, his cronies, as you call them. Did you get any indication from President Biden that that would be his next move?
I hope that the USA will impose stronger sanctions on Belarusian regime and close loopholes that were left after European Union sanctions.
But you did not get any promises from President Biden or any indication that that would be something that he would look to do?
No, I didn't take any promises. It's a prerogative of President Biden and his team to fulfill or not fulfill what we are asking for.
You know, it's interesting because one of the reasons, perhaps, and those that follow Belarus and Russia, many had been speculating why this meeting had not taken place yet. You had been in the United States for quite a few days and weeks now. And one theory was that this administration, President Biden, didn't want to further the tensions between him and Vladimir Putin following their meeting in Geneva. Obviously, there are other issues on the docket, including cyber attacks and what have you. Now that this meeting took place, given how close Lukashenko is and how much he relies on President Putin, I'm wondering whether you think this was a message that President Biden was trying to send Vladimir Putin. Did his name come up at all during this meeting?
No, this meeting didn't happen while our first visit to Washington, because you know that President Biden has the toughest schedule in the world. So we have this fact of meeting, it's wonderful. And of course, this is clear message to Belarusian people, to the cronies of the regime and other states, that the USA is on the side of light, but not on the side of darkness.
But did you speak about Vladimir Putin at all?
We were concentrated on Belarus.
I know you said that you were there not only for yourself and representing the nation, but for the 35,000 plus Belarusians who have been detained without any reason back home in their countries. Many journalists have been targeted as well. The opposition movement there really has been suppressed by Lukashenko over the past few months. And you yourself said that it needed a spark. Do you think that meeting with President Biden, even though it was just 15 minutes, but that picture was seen around the world, do you think that was the spark that can reignite that movement?
No, our movement is continuing. It's still there, and nobody is giving up in Belarus, despite of huge repressions in Belarus. And, of course, this meeting will not spark people, because people are already sparkled, but This is about messaging. This is about on whom side the greatest democracy is.
This is a personal issue for you, not only because you represent Belarus and want to see a brighter, more democratic future for the country, but because your husband is one of those that's detained as well. You and your children have not seen him now in a year. You would only exchange letters with him, and he was the one who initially had been thought of as the politician who could possibly bring down the Lukashenko regime. You were his wife, a school teacher, and now here you are. Along with him and Roman Protasevich, how are they doing, and how are you doing, given how personal this is for you?
You know, our political prisoners and those who are behind the bars because of political wishes, you know, they are in awful position in behind the bars because their conditions of staying are awful. People are sleeping on the floor and without mattresses. They are lack of fresh air. They are lack of normality. They are humiliated psychologically and physically every day. And we have a lot of women there and who have on freedom, and of course the situation is awful. You know, as for me, you know, the most I experience now is tiredness, but I understand that I can't stop because I'm the same as all the Belarusians are responsible for those who are behind the bars now, who sacrificed with their freedom and health and lives just to give us opportunity to fight further. And this is our responsibility, and we have to continue maybe with small steps, but just move forward.
I know we'd mentioned the question of whether or not the U.S. would impose further sanctions that you have suggested and spoken about publicly. Did the president offer any suggestion to fulfill one of your other requests, and that is supporting your movement financially?
We are asking support for political prisoners, for their families. We are asking support for relocants who continue to resist abroad. And I'm sure that this help will be increased in the nearest future.
From the United States specifically?
Yeah.
Final question for you. I know that Lukashenko has definitely been boxed in over the last year. That is for sure. You have now met with more world leaders than he has. I believe it's only three or four that he has met with. But for longer term, you are still not allowed. You're not going back to your country. You are living in another country for your own safety. As someone who is the face of the opposition movement there, what is next for you? Can you lead this movement successfully when you're not in the country itself?
No, we communicate to the people on the ground every day. We understand what's going on inside Belarus. And I'm going to other countries looking for allies on behalf of all Belarusians. And I can't say that I'm leading this uprising, leading this revolution, because everybody in Belarus and in exile are leaders. It's our task is to do what you can. I can visit other countries, meeting with the president and so on. But those who are in Belarus and making very small but so important step, doing not less than me. So only our united activities will bring us to new elections.
Well, I could say once again, just to reiterate, that this was a meeting that no one expected, and it was quite surprising. And I'm sure it may have been just as surprising to people back on the streets in Belarus and to Lukashenko himself there in Minsk. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Russian security officers raided the home of Roman Doprokhotov, editor of independent news site The Insider in Russia. Alexei Kovalev is a colleague of Doprokhotov, and he oversees the investigative reporting at the Medusa news site and joins me now from Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we talk about what's going on the ground there in Moscow, I'm just curious to get your response to this surprising meeting between Tikhanovskaya and Biden yesterday, just from the perspective of the Kremlin and how it's being received in Russia.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, of course, if you look at the Russian state media, they are incredibly denigrating about this, and there is a whole genre there in the Russian state media and news agencies of, you know, making mockery of these meetings between the leaders of Ukraine and Belarus with Americans, because, well, the whole point of it is of this coverage is to make sure that the viewers understand that, you know, leaders of this country are not sovereign. They are all American lackeys. So that's what's going on, basically.
And this is all happening right when we have another meeting coming up in the White House with Ukrainian President Zelensky. I believe that's scheduled to take place next week. I can only imagine how the Russian state media will be covering that. But in terms of what independent journalists are covering, you know, for people like yourself and your colleagues, it's becoming more and more of a dangerous occupation. As we mentioned, Roman Dobrokhodorov, who was the editor-in-chief of The Insider. And we should just note that The Insider works very closely with Bellingcat, who did that bombshell investigative report along with CNN, right, to track down the origins and who was behind the poisoning of Alexei Navalny. His home was raided. His phone was taken. It does appear, as I'm following Russian media every single day, that this is becoming something that happens quite frequently. And from your perspective, given that this happened to Medusa as well, they've been labeled a foreign agent, how much further, how much worse can things get?
Oh, they can get much, much worse. I mean, look at Belarus. I mean, we're not there yet. We're probably a few months behind. You know, I'm really, most of us are really past the point of being afraid. It's right now, it's just incredibly tiring. You know, every morning I'm waking up and checking my phone to see if there are any ongoing raids. You know, just first to make sure that the police are not ramming down my door or the doors of my parents. The next time checking if there are ongoing raids on my colleagues, and if not, so I'm thinking, so what am I going to do today? Am I going to do any actual public service journalism, or am I going to document the demise of my own industry? It's just really frustrating. I was just talking with a colleague who had to shut down kind of preemptively before being declared a foreign agent, because they heard through the grapevine that this probably was going to happen in the nearest future, and they shut down the media organization. And we were discussing this, and we both thought it's really frustrating to be spending the best years, the most productive years of our professional lives on this, because it's not just being afraid of those raids. These laws, these foreign agent laws, and one organization was even declared an undesirable organization, like Proyekt, another investigative outlet. And they just really had to evacuate their employees out of the country, because it's now simply illegal for anyone to work with them or even post links to their website.
And the one comment.
But, yeah.
I was going to say the one commonality seems to be that they are at times critical and objective when it comes to reporting on domestic affairs, specifically the Kremlin. Can you give our viewers an indication of what it means to be labeled a foreign agent, an undesirable? I follow your website. Perhaps many people don't. They should. But it does come with many warnings now that just really are an eyesore.
Well, it's designed to be so. I mean, and it's also a legal minefield. So after I check my phone for any ongoing raids on the homes of my colleagues, during the day I'll have to check every story I file and upload on the website, to make sure that I really put all those ugly legal disclaimers on the names of all those other organizations that have been declared undesirable or extremist, to make sure that I'm not fined for omitting this disclaimer. And it's by design. It's there. These laws are to make sure that our jobs are as absurdly difficult as they can be, to discourage us from doing this job in the first place. That's the whole point. And they'll tell you. The criminal will tell you that the Russian foreign agent law is really just a model, is really just a carbon copy of the Foreign Agents Registration Act in the United States. But of course, unlike FARA, which is only applied to lobbyists of powerful industry groups or governments, Russian foreign agents law is applied to individual persons, and it's designed to make their jobs harder, to drive them out of profession, and to rob them of their livelihoods. Because I'm seeing messages on Facebook from people who have been declared, individual persons who have been declared foreign agents here in Russia. And it's just in July alone, I think it's just 13 people already have been declared foreign agents. And they can't work as journalists anymore. So people are looking for jobs outside of journalism because no one will employ them now because it's just too legally dangerous.
Or they leave the country, right? Which I guess is another intent there, another another wish from many in the Kremlin. Can you explain what this means or how it's being perceived by average Russians who may not be so tuned in with the field of journalism, but perhaps aren't just watching state media either?
Well, there has been an incredible wave of support for Meduza. We were declared foreign agents in April. And, you know, the wave of support, we were just really thinking of closing shop and just going away because it's just, you know, who knows what's going to happen to us. But no, actually, dozens of thousands of people wrote to us and donated money to our crowdfunding campaign. So we keep going. So it's really, really encouraging. So it means that people really need us. But at some point, I mean, that was back in April. Since then, dozens of people have been declared foreign agents and two organizations. One of them was also declared on top of that, an undesirable organization. And as time goes, you know, people can donate money to one of their favorite websites, maybe two, maybe three. But when it's a dozen of them, two dozens, it's just there is only so much resource that people can so much support and physical resource that people can donate.
And
but
there's no
that's the whole point.
And yeah. There's no coincidence of the timing too. We're just weeks away from the Duma elections there, the parliamentary elections in Russia. Just a few days ago, the Russian federal censor blocked Alexei Navalny's main site along with 40 plus other sites that are associated with him. Can you talk about the significance of that alone and not allowing ordinary Russians to be able to go to such sites as they are thinking about who they are going to vote for in September?
Well, of course, not only Alexei Navalny himself is in prison, but of course, all of his closest supporters have been barred from running in these elections. But not just that. You know, now it's because his organization is, for all intents and purposes, illegal in Russia. Anyone who's ever been associated with them in any way, donated money to them or volunteered for one of their campaigns, and that is hundreds of thousands of people. All of these people, too, have been disenfranchised from running in these elections. So even anyone from the so-called systemic parties, that means those that are sitting in the parliament and have the unspoken support of the Kremlin. Even if you belong to one of those parties and you express support for Alexei Navalny, you will also be barred from running. So that's where we are now. Any contact whatsoever, any expression of support for Alexei Navalny will put you on the Kremlin's naughty list.
I've been, as I mentioned, following Russian, you know, news there closely, and I have to say, even the most negative of analysts there, who were jaded going into this year and Alexei Navalny's return, are still stunned by how the speed at which this crackdown has taken place. And just lastly, can you put it in a global perspective for us? You know, there are so many issues on the agenda between President Biden and Vladimir Putin, especially those that impact Americans and our allies. But can you explain to our viewers why this crackdown is so detrimental to Russia and its future, and why more of the world should be paying attention?
Okay, so imagine that the only news you will be getting from one of the largest countries in the world is just statements from Russian foreign ministry and news briefs from Russian state media, and that's going to be it, because that's where we're heading right now. And I don't think it's a healthy situation at all. It doesn't, you know, there is no other scenario now. If we are heading in the same direction we are heading now, there is no winning scenario in this for anyone, because it means just like 30 years ago in the Soviet Union, it means that the country is heading towards swift gradual decline, and that doesn't bode well for anyone, for its closest neighbors, for the West, or anyone.
Makes the world a more dangerous place. I just think about an article you wrote where your mom warned you when you came back to Russia, why did you come back? And you said the heyday, the future of journalism was going to be there in Russia. And I hate to see your mom being proven right on this issue. But we, of course, will continue to follow the story and your reporting. Alexei Korolev, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to switch gears now to the Olympics. American gymnast Suni Lee celebrated her gold medal in women's gymnastics in Tokyo today, extending the run of 5 all-around Olympic golds for Team USA.
This medal definitely means a lot to me because there was a point in time where I wanted to quit, and I just didn't think I would ever get here, including injuries and stuff. So there are definitely a lot of emotions, but I'm super proud of myself for sticking with it and believing in myself, because this medal would not be possible without my coaches, the medical team, my parents, and it just is so surreal, and I haven't even let it sink in yet.
Such a powerful moment, especially to hear that she is proud of herself for all of that hard work. Lee's teammate Simone Biles cheered her on from the sidelines after withdrawing from competition this week to protect her mental health. For elite athletes like Lee or Biles, psychological issues can cause real physical harm. Dr. Colleen Hacker is a mental skills coach for Olympic athletes and an authority on the psychology of peak performance. Dr. Hacker joins us live. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hacker. And I think it is so important to begin there and talk about how related mental health is with physical health, because Simone Biles was asked how she is feeling physically, and she said, physically, I'm fine. But we know there is a connection with mental health and physical health. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. And I just am smiling at and marveling at that interview with our newest gold medalist.
Fantastic.
I mean, it's incredible. And without a question, the physical excellence is inextricably linked to psychological resilience and to mental health. We don't come at performance as compartmentalized human beings. We don't perform in the Olympic Games with just our bodies. We are integrated. It is our entire selves. And I will say, quite frankly, at the Olympic Games or any major competition, everything is a performance issue. Every aspect that affects our lives as human beings comes with us to the performance domain.
So talk about the role that you play, the critical role. You have worked with soccer teams, ice hockey, and U.S. women's swimming as well. What do you do with these athletes, and how do you coach them along with their trainers, their physical trainers? How do you coach them to maintain their mental health?
Right. Well, there is always a team behind the team. There's always a team behind each individual athlete. I've been fortunate to serve on 6 Olympic Games coaching staffs, and as you mentioned, in a variety of sports, and then worked with a significant number of individual Olympians. What I bring to the equation, I'm a certified mental performance consultant, and I'm listed in the United States Olympic and Paralympic Sports Psychology Registry, and my focus is on the performance enhancement side. So I work with athletes around issues like dealing with the pressure, dealing with the distractions that are common in the Olympic Games. Imagery, for example, we know from research that 97 to 98% of Olympic athletes use imagery on a consistent basis. We work on their self-talk, on their breathing techniques, on mindfulness. And so a whole host of variables along the performance enhancement. Well, alongside folks like me, enhancement side, are all clinical sports psychologists that work with athletes around medical issues. So these are the things like clinical anxiety that we're talking about now, trauma, eating disorders, suicide ideation, testing positive for COVID, substance abuse. So these two groups of professionals work hand in hand, the performance enhancement side and the mental health side. I'm on one side of the equation and am fortunate to work with many of the best in the world at their particular craft.
I was following some of the lessons that you encourage your athletes to try, and the four square, the breathing, taking in four breaths and drawing a square on your stomach. That I felt like that was very therapeutic in the moment that I tried it myself. The significance of Simone Biles, we talk about teachable moments, but to have the greatest gymnast of all time, arguably, the face of U.S. Olympics, bow out gracefully, talk about the need to focus on her mental health, and then tweet today, "The outpouring love and support I've received has made me realize I'm more than my accomplishments in gymnastics, which I never truly believed before." Without going too far here and taking away from the games, is this just an aha moment for spectators, for athletes, for the world to see that even the most accomplished of champions and athletes has these struggles?
Without question, my first Olympic Games were in the 1996 Olympic Games. And while we knew that athletes are human beings first, and I say that because every potential issue that we face as human beings, as non-Olympians, are part of Olympians' lives. So current estimates are anywhere from 15 to 30% of Olympic athletes are or have experienced mental health issues at some point in their lives. That mirrors the data from the general population. But in 96, it was, on the back shelf. It was known, but marginalized. You didn't hear athletes coming forward. You didn't hear coaches discussing the need for this. There wasn't a cultural or societal shift. We have seen over the course of my career, not just a gradual shift, but an exponential growth in athletes' willingness to be honest and vulnerable and to share with the world, in my view, that they come at performance as entire human beings. And that means that they are more willing to talk about their mental health issues. You know, this is not new. And when I say this, I mean that sport and athletics sort of leading the world into a new era of understanding and interest. It's athletes are frequently change agents, whether it's social issues or health and fitness issues, or in these Olympic Games, mental health issues. So I just cannot celebrate or compliment these Olympians. For many people, it began with Michael Phelps, and then Naomi Osaka, and then Simone Biles, and they are normalizing and they are naming the reality of mental health as part of life and part of the performance domain. I cannot celebrate them enough.
Right, and it's causing us to revisit some of the things that we'd seen transpire in Olympics past, right? You think about the 1996 Olympics. Dominique Moceanu tweeted this just yesterday in response to Simone Biles' decision, her brave decision, and she was applauding her. She said, "I was 14 years old with a tibial stress fracture, left alone with no cervical spine exam after the fall. I competed in the Olympics floor final minutes later. I never felt I had a say as an Olympian." She could have broken her neck. I remember watching that and her falling on her head. Carrie Shrug said the same thing, that heroic moment where she landed on one foot. She come to find out that wasn't even something she needed to compete in for them to win a medal. And yet she did. How important is it for us as spectators and for you as a coach and for Olympians and for athletes to look back at these moments and learn from them as well moving forward?
We do need to revisit history. We do need to revisit our awareness of what actually transpired versus the portrayal of what transpired. And I think that too is a seminal moment for viewers, because I honestly believe that for the last 36 hours, 48 hours, I believe the viewing public is learning for the first time the reality of the competitive situation in different sports, for different athletes, in different Olympic Games. We thought we knew. We thought we knew. We thought we understood the narrative. And then we sort of mythologize it. We make heroes and heroines of these moments. What I can tell you, quite frankly, I have never worked with USA Gymnastics, so I want to make that clear. But I can tell you that those on the inside do know an alternative narrative. They are aware of these realities, but there is such tremendous pressure. And I cannot emphasize the very real consequences of speaking out and coming forward. It's just easier to be silent. It's just easier to accept the narrative. This is why you hear previous Olympians. This is why you hear the outpouring of support from athletes on the professional side and the Olympic side, recognizing these moments as the true heroic moments. They are authentic. They are brave. They are true. They are honest. And I think most of us would be better served to understand the true story rather than the varnished story.
Yeah, and perhaps that's why the International Olympics Committee was so quick to come out and say that they're offering a 24-hour hotline available in 70 languages to help safeguard these players, these athletes, and they're going to have somebody there who will be of assistance if they need someone to talk to. Very quickly before you go, can you just finish this sentence for me? Because everybody, athletes and everyday people have butterflies. You say butterflies are important to have, but what?
Absolutely. Anytime we do something that's important and meaningful and the outcome matters, we all experience butterflies. I don't want people to get rid of the butterflies. I want them to learn how to get those butterflies to fly in formation.
I love that. I love that. And I love your love pillow behind you. Dr. Hacker, it's been wonderful talking to you and very teachable moments here as we watch these Olympians. Thank you so much. Well, now to the pandemic. Today, President Biden will announce a vaccination requirement for federal workers. This as vaccine hesitancy persists despite the rapid spread of the Delta variant. In Tennessee, where only 39% are fully inoculated, Republican senators are now urging people to get protected. But Dr. Michelle Fiscus says that she was fired from the state's health department over a push to get teens vaccinated. Here she is speaking to Hari Srinivasan alongside critical care doctor Jason Martin about all the controversy.
Bianna, thanks, Dr. Michelle Fiscus. Dr. Jason Martin, thank you both for joining us. First, Dr. Fiscus, for our audience members who haven't been paying attention to what's been happening in Tennessee, why are you now the former medical director of the Tennessee Vaccine and Immunization Program? What led to that?
Well, thanks for having me on, Hari. I sent out a memo to our COVID-19 vaccine providers in Tennessee, letting them know about the mature minor doctrine in Tennessee, which has been in place since 1987 and allows that children ages 14 and older can seek medical care on their own without parental consent if their medical provider feels that that individual is mature enough to make those decisions.
What were you trying to accomplish?
Well, the memo that I sent out was in response to requests for information from those very providers who wanted to know, you know, what do I do if a 15-year-old drives up, you know, with some friends and asks for a vaccine? Can we provide it to them or not? And so I reached out to our Office of General Counsel for that language and shared that. And that is what some of our legislators felt was trying to undermine parental authority, and which eventually led to my termination from the department.
Now, the chief medical officer of the state, I want to read a quote here. They said this is because of, quote, failure to maintain good working relationships with members of her team, her lack of effective leadership, her lack of appropriate management, and unwillingness to consult with superiors and other internal stakeholders on projects. What do you say to that?
Well, I sent an 8-page point-by-point rebuttal to that information that was released. Interesting that that letter that was dated July the 9th was not shared with me at my termination on July the 12th. And there are aspects of that letter that are demonstrably false. For example, the claim that I didn't consult with legal counsel before sending out the mature minor doctrine letter to providers, when actually the information that I sent out was provided to me by the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Health.
And Dr. Martin, how often does something like this get so heated, so political in your time as a doctor in Tennessee?
Yeah, this is the hottest I've ever seen the political rhetoric in the state of Tennessee, and certainly the most consequential rhetoric that I've witnessed in my practice of medicine. I mean, the disruption that's taking place with our chief vaccine officer in the Department of Health could not have come at a worse time for Tennesseans. It's at a time when, unfortunately, vaccination adoption has been low for multiple reasons, mainly because the messaging from the executive, I think, has been insufficient. But also we have the spread of the Delta variant. And so we have this huge unvaccinated population that's susceptible to this increasingly infectious and deadly variant. And so, you know, the disruption from a political angle couldn't come at a worse time for us.
Dr. Fiskus, put Tennessee in perspective for us. I mean, I've heard that the vaccination rate is about 10% lower than the national average. I mean, what is the goal that you would want to see Tennessee at? And how can you change people's minds at this point?
Well, I want to see every eligible Tennessean who can get vaccinated, get vaccinated. I think we lose perspective about the toll that this pandemic has taken, that we've lost more lives than we have in any pandemic over the last 100 years, including the 1918 influenza pandemic. We are crushing our healthcare system, our healthcare workers, and our public health infrastructure. I am the 25th of 64 immunization directors across the country to either leave or lose their job over the course of the pandemic. So that's critical public health infrastructure that's being lost at a very critical time. It's in Tennessee, and I think in a lot of the southern states, we find ourselves in public health at this very uncomfortable spot where we're trying to share CDC guidance and encourage people to follow CDC guidance, but then we have a group of citizen legislators and elected officials who are more interested in appealing to their base and their voters and thinking about their next political win than they are about looking at what's going to save the people who are actually voting for them.
Dr. Martin, it seems like there's a direct consequence when public health officials like Dr. Fiskus and her peers across the country are either leaving their professions or fired or being pushed out. It seems that that's the preventative side of medicine. And when that doesn't work, they show up at your door.
That's right. I mean, it's a tragedy that we're losing so much institutional expertise because we really need that expertise right now to get us through this pandemic. And when the preventative side of the equation falls apart, then that fills up our hospitals, and that leads to more death and more tragedy.
Dr. Fiskus, what was the public health department doing to try to decrease hesitancy in specific communities that have lower rates?
Well, our office, or TDH's Office of Minority Health and Disparities Elimination, has done a yeoman's work in being on the ground and working with faith-based communities and organizations across the state to help get hesitant populations, for example, our Black or Hispanic populations, vaccinated, and has just done a tremendous amount of work, as have all of the local departments of health. Where we weren't successful in being able to message out was just general public messaging about the importance of the vaccine, about messages to build vaccine confidence across the state. We had asked the governor's office for that kind of public messaging from months before the vaccines were ever available in Tennessee. And we just were never permitted to put out any kind of messaging. And so public messaging around getting the vaccine really didn't even hit airways in Tennessee until sometime around the middle of May, unfortunately, when we could have been building that vaccine confidence for months, even prior to vaccines becoming available to Tennesseans.
Dr. Martin, the hesitation that you are still seeing, what are the reasons that people are coming up with to you when they end up in the hospital and you or your colleagues ask them, why didn't you get vaccinated?
You know, after we build a rapport with patients, I often do respectfully ask them, you know, why didn't you get the vaccine? Because, you know, here you are in this life-threatening situation. And we have data that shows that there's a preventative medication. Why didn't you take it? And they tell me that they just didn't think it was going to happen to them. You know, the populations that we're seeing right now are younger than the previous wave. And so I feel like they thought they were going to get through this without having any significant trouble. And so they're surprised, they're shocked, they're saddened by what's happening. We had a patient in their 20s come into the hospital, and that patient was, you know, crying on my shoulder, basically saying that they wish they had gotten the vaccine because they realize now that it would save them from, you know, potentially dying. And, you know, that is when you hold the hands of someone like that who's critically ill, and you can't take it away from them. You know, you all you can do is do your best with the therapies that you have on hand. But it's just a sorrow that you cannot describe to see someone suffering that way when it's completely preventable. You know, at the beginning of this pandemic, there was loss of life that was, I think, inevitable. But now we know what to do. And that makes the loss of life so much more tragic when politics, raw politics, is affecting folks' adoption of this life-saving intervention.
Dr. Fiskus, are you surprised that some of these rumors and conspiracies are still so persistent so late in this pandemic?
I'm dismayed by that. And you know, there are so many rumors, not just about this vaccine, but about other childhood vaccines that are critical to the health of children as well. But I think, you know, the other thing in Tennessee, and I think in a lot of our southern states that's happening, is this ideology that if you get this vaccine, you're somehow placating the left part of the political spectrum. And so what we're actually seeing is our most hesitant population in Tennessee is the white male rural conservative, and that they are stating that, you know, they're not going to get the vaccine really out of spite, and are willing to put their own lives and the lives of the people that they love at risk because they feel that if they get the vaccine, then they have placated the left or done what the Biden administration wants them to do.
So, you know, Dr. Martin, when I speak to other doctors here in New York or elsewhere, I also detect a shift in the tone that there was a greater amount of patience and understanding at the beginning of the pandemic. And now, frankly, there's exasperation, fatigue, even a lack of sort of empathy fatigue, perhaps, just that's setting in saying, come on, you've had access now. And now here you are and your beds are filling up again.
That's right. Let me sort of describe the arc of emotions over the last 16 months. I mean, it's been an extraordinary time. I would say the beginning of the pandemic was filled with fear and anticipation. And sadness and also determination to get through it. And, you know, your healthcare providers, we spent, you know, most of our lives over the last 16 months in the hospital, you know, putting our own personal safety at risk to try to get people through this. And, you know, we held up a lot of iPads while moms and dads and brothers and sisters, you know, wailed at the loss of their loved ones remotely. I can't describe to you how impactful those moments are. You know, it's just, if you've never been there, you know, I really want to convey to people, it is incredibly impactful to everybody in the room, the family, the patient, obviously, the healthcare providers. And then as we worked through that over the subsequent year, really, we got to a place a couple of months ago where we felt like we had succeeded. We got down to zero COVID patients in the hospitals that I work at. And so now we feel COVID creeping back into our community. We see these sick people coming in again. We're having to intubate patients again and cry with their loved ones as they pass away again. And we're just thinking, it doesn't have to be this way. Why are we doing this again? There's a fix to this problem. It's widely available. It's free. It's safe. Why can't people stand up, speak the truth, and make it a priority to save the health and life of Tennesseans by telling people to get this vaccine?
Dr. Fiskus, I know you're a trained pediatrician, and you might go back to doing this. Right now, there's a lot of parents around the country concerned, especially with children who are under 12, saying, oh, is this a crapshoot here? I mean, should I be sending my child back to a building? Will a mask be enough? Are kids stronger than adults? I mean, even if the data says that there's very few kids that get very badly sick, a parent says, well, I just don't want my child to be that one in a million, right?
Right. And it's not, you know, one in a million that gets very sick. You know, in Tennessee, we've had 200 kids that have fallen victim to multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, which puts these kids in intensive care units, on dialysis, on ventilators, gives them what may be permanent heart damage. You know, that's way more common than one in a million type of issue. You know, for parents who are have children who are 12 and older, they need to get them vaccinated. And for those that are not eligible yet, hopefully we're going to get FDA EUA soon for that, at least the 5 to 11 group. But I would not be sending my child to school without a mask. Even if they're vaccinated, you know, these children are going to be sitting in small spaces, 7.5 hours a day, unable to distance themselves from the people around them. And those that are 11 and under are, you know, really sitting ducks with this Delta variant that is more infectious and more, is causing more illness in children. And we're seeing that, you know, across the states with children being admitted to intensive care units, where we didn't see that earlier in the pandemic with the initial strains.
You know, Dr. Fiskus, that seems to be one of these sort of sticking points with people who are against vaccinations. It's, oh, look, the CDC said we didn't need masks. Then they said we did. And then now they said we didn't. And then here they are saying we do again.
It's hard. And it's really hard for the public because, you know, no science is ever settled. And it's really important that the public is listening to credible sources of information and understands that it's a good thing that recommendations are changing, because that means we're learning. What's unfortunate is when we hear elected officials say, we won't issue another mask mandate, or we won't close down the economy again, because we don't know what things are going to look like in 2 or 3 or 4 weeks from now. And so to make those declarations when we don't know what Delta is going to do and Lambda after that, and understanding that until we get everyone vaccinated, we're going to continue to see these more and more virulent strains come through. We have got to be nimble in our response to this, and hopefully the public will begin to understand that.
Dr. Martin, what's this been like for you, and what's the toll that it has taken on you? How do you measure that? How does your family, if I was asking them 5 years from now, what did COVID do to Jason Martin?
It's been awful. And, you know, as part of my job as a critical care physician, I'm accustomed to dealing with death, but not this much death. It seems every day I have to, you know, hold up an iPad and listen to someone say goodbye. And this is not just me. It's all the folks who are on the front lines. I mean, you know, it's hard to be positive and chipper when you go home after a really bad day in the ICU. It's hard to be present for your kids when you're emotionally struggling. So it's a very difficult journey for us, but we're committed to doing it.
Dr. Fiskus, this week, New York took a step. Governor Cuomo said that state employees here, that they had to be vaccinated. And you even had the governor of Alabama, who said outright that it's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down. I mean, what combination, Dr. Fiskus, is going to work here? Carrot, stick, pressure? How do you get through? And what do you want to see? Is that the right track?
yes, I think it's the time for sticks in some cases. And, you know, to have healthcare professionals or individuals who are working in nursing homes who have refused to be vaccinated, who are putting not only themselves, but the patients that they're caring for at risk on a continuing basis is not acceptable. And, you know, there are other requirements when you work in healthcare. You can't smoke inside a hospital. And if you want to smoke inside a hospital, then you don't get to work there. This is the same kind of health threat. And so requiring healthcare workers, requiring federal workers, requiring state workers to be vaccinated or find another role for their employment, I think is something where, you know, we're there at this point, because the other things just haven't gotten, especially states like Tennessee, to get those vaccination numbers up yet.
Dr. Michelle Fiskus, Dr. Jason Martin, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
And finally, San Marino has become the smallest nation to win an Olympic medal. Alessandra Pirelli shot her way to bronze in women's trap shooting. The medal is an Olympic first for San Marino. And earlier this week, Flora Duffy scored a similar achievement for Bermuda, striking gold in the women's triathlon. Congratulations to all winners, big and small countries alike. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.